The headlines, the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank this year rises to 67 amid heightened tensions in the occupied territories. The U.S. approves the potential sale of new weapons to Taiwan despite China's repeated warnings against such moves. And reports coming out of Ukraine say Russian forces are edging closer to capturing the strategic eastern city of Bakhmut. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, a young Palestinian man has succumbed to injuries he recently sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jericho, also known as Ariha. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 22-year-old Mahmoud Jamal Hamdan was critically wounded during an Israeli attack on a refugee camp. Witnesses said that Hamdan was being treated by Palestinian medics, but Israeli soldiers halted the treatment and took him to a military jeep. Several other Palestinians were also arrested during the raid that took place on Monday night. Israel has practically sealed off Jericho since a shooting incident on a highway outside the city that left an Israeli soldier dead. The regime claims Hamdan was involved in the attack. His death brings to 67 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank this year so far. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us with details about unending Israeli raids on the occupied West Bank.
This morning we received that the Israeli forces, after imposing a tight closure on Ariha, the city of Jericho, the Israeli soldiers removed all the roadblocks there, claiming that the main reason for the incursion was to arrest Palestinians, and they did so. Anyways, in the city of Jericho, a day of mourning and a general strike has been declared to mourn this young Palestinian man. We have to mention that in the non-stop operations into Jericho City led to the killing of five Palestinians last month. More condemnations, this is what the Palestinians are receiving from the international community, and calls for both the Palestinians and the Israelis to stop any form of confrontations. But what's going on is Israeli occupiers, Israeli settlers, backed and supported by fully armed soldiers, they continue to raid the cities, the refugee camps and the areas, shoot and kill Palestinians, arrest others, destroy homes and confiscate lands. But at the same time, the international community is only condemning this unacceptable act by the Israelis, that even they do not see it as crimes or massacres or even illegal practices against the Palestinians.
An educational institute in Gaza has held a cultural festival aimed at displaying various traditions and cultures from around the world. The organizers say the festival is an opportunity to introduce the world beyond the Israeli blockade to Gazan children. Ola Alassi reports from Gaza.
For most people in Gaza, it's just a dream to travel and explore the world outside the Israeli cruel blockade. The new generation has lived almost all its whole life under the Israeli siege, learning about the world only through screens. The longest-standing Israeli restriction on the movement of people and goods to and from Gaza has undermined the living conditions of over 2 million Palestinian residents.
The idea of this festival is that children of Gaza rarely travel abroad, and it's hard to get out of Gaza to discover the countries around the world. We sought to bring the world's countries to our children and introduce the different cultures through a collection of famous Flint statues, food and clothes, cultures in general.
Al-Amal Institute for Orphans in Gaza is an independent non-governmental organization that pursues to bring about positive change in the culture of the community and raise awareness about the orphans and their needs in order to ensure a better life for them and their families.
Yahala from around the world comes as a message to the whole world that Palestine is also part of the world. Therefore, this message reaches the world that the crossings should be open to facilitate traveling for our children and us, so we can visit these countries and communicate widely with the neighboring and other countries.
The Israeli blockade of the occupied Gaza Strip in its current form has been in place since June 27, when Israel imposed a full-scale land, sea, and air blockade on the area. The siege contravenes Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment that prevents the realization of a broad range of human rights. Three Gaza children died in 2022 as a result of the Israeli occupation authorities' delays or refusal to grant them permits to exit Gaza for medical treatment.
We hope such event has a positive effect on our students, and they are part of the history and the glory, and they are capable of breaking the siege and the Israeli blockade want to break their will. They have a great civilization, and this affects their psychological and social well-being.
The beleaguered Palestinians in Gaza live in a cycle of a struggle, located, imprisoned, and denied basic human rights and needs. Now entering its 18th year, the Israeli blockade created a generation seeing a window to the world outside. These kinds of events are a glimmer of hope for the children who one day want to break the siege and restore their right to freedom of movement. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
In a further sign of warming ties with Syria, more Arab diplomats have made trips to Damascus for the first time since the 2011 war on Syria. Iran has hailed the development as a positive step towards solidarity, emphasizing that dialogue and regional approaches can solve the woes besetting the region.
Tehran has described the recent developments in relations between Arab countries and Syria as a positive step. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the recent progress in relations between Arab countries and Syria, including the visit by parliamentary delegations to Damascus to express solidarity with Syria following the recent devastating earthquake, in addition to being a realistic approach, is a positive step toward Islamic solidarity. He added that regional countries will be able to resolve their problems through dialogue and regional mechanisms if they act realistically, adopt an independent national stance, and pay no heed to the demands of the hegemonic powers. After a deadly quake hit Syria's northern region on February 6th, Syria-Arab relations have further improved, with regional countries sending humanitarian aid to the country amid U.S. sanctions. A delegation from the Arab Interparliamentary Union visited Damascus on Sunday in a show of support for the country. The high-profile visit was amid attempts by certain countries, above all Iraq, to restore Syria's membership in the Arab League. More than a decade after it was suspended from the 22-member bloc in 2011. In a meeting with the delegation, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said the visit means a lot to the Syrian people as it indicates support to the Syrians, who are exposed as a result of the terrorist war and the repercussions of the quake. For his part, the head of the Arab Interparliamentary Union, Mohammed al-Halbousi, who is also Iraq's parliament speaker, affirmed that the delegation came to Syria on behalf of all members of the union to assure the Syrian people of their step toward the process of standing with Syria and solidarity with its people. He added, "This visit also came to confirm the importance of working at all levels in order for Damascus to return to exercising its active role in the Arab world." Also, on Monday, in further signs of warming ties with Syria, Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry met with the Syrian president in the first visit by a top Egyptian envoy to Damascus in more than 10 years. Conveying Cairo's message of solidarity with Syria, Shoukry also expressed Cairo's willingness to strengthen bilateral relations. He held discussions with his Syrian counterpart Faisal Miqdad as well. The Arab League suspended Syria's membership in November 2011, citing an alleged crackdown by Damascus on opposition protests. Syria has denounced the move as illegal and a violation of the organization's charter.
There seems to be a change on the horizon regarding many Arab states and their relationship with Syria. Since the February 6th earthquake that hit both Turkey and Syria, several Arab diplomats have used the chance to go to Syria and meet with President Bashar al-Assad. Meanwhile, Washington has urged the international community not to let humanitarian assistance to Syria be accompanied by normalization with Bashar al-Assad's government, fearing that the 6th of February disaster will end up in an Arab embrace of Damascus.
Since the devastating earthquake struck Turkey and Syria, Washington has continuously refused any coordination with the Syrian government, deeming it counterproductive and calling on its allies to refrain from engaging with Damascus. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price urged the international community in a briefing on 27th of February not to let humanitarian assistance to Syria be accompanied by normalization with Bashar al-Assad's government. Although some of Washington's Arab allies remain aligned with U.S. policy on Syria, such as Qatar and Kuwait, the earthquake has seemingly initiated a broader Arab embrace of Syria. Countries such as Saudi Arabia, who supported extremist groups that fought against the government, have now expressed a need to end the status quo of enmity with Damascus, particularly for humanitarian purposes. Several Arab states, including Algeria, Tunisia, and Iraq, all disregarded the risk of U.S. sanctions by providing aid to Damascus through the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. After falsely claiming that sanctions do not harm the Syrian people, Washington had to issue a temporary waiver following the storm of criticism against its Syria policy. This is despite the fact that U.S. sanctions against Syria have been deemed a violation of human rights and international law by experts. As a result of these sanctions, food costs have surged dramatically, an overall health crisis has been exacerbated, and humanitarian aid has been impeded both before and after the earthquake. At the same time, U.S. military forces illegally occupied Syria and provided assistance to extremist armed groups. They have also looted massive amounts of the country's wheat and oil. Since the start of the U.S.-backed war in 2011, Syria's oil ministry has incurred losses of at least $107.1 billion as a result of Washington's policies.
The United States has approved the potential sale of new weapons to Taiwan in a move likely to worsen tensions between Beijing and Taipei. According to the Pentagon, the State Department has agreed to sell weapons worth $620 million to Taiwan. The package would include modern range missiles for the island's F-16 warplanes, as well as high-speed anti-radiation missiles. Taiwan's defense ministry says the arms and equipments would help stand against, quote, threats and provocation from the Chinese military. Beijing has repeatedly condemned the U.S. arming of Taiwan, saying that Washington is bolstering separatists on the self-ruled island. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and says that it's committed to protecting its sovereignty. Russian forces have intensified their attacks in eastern Ukraine and are edging closer to capturing the city of Bakhmut. The Ukrainian military says the Russians are now advancing toward the city from all directions. On Wednesday, a Ukrainian lawmaker acknowledged that the city would fall into the hands of Russian forces sooner or later. He said the defense of Bakhmut can go on indefinitely, but there's no sense in holding it at any cost. Separately, President Volodymyr Zelensky said his forces are keeping each frontline sector under control, but described the battle for Bakhmut as the most difficult one. The capture of Bakhmut would pave the way for Russian forces to seize the rest of the strategic Donbass region bordering Russia. Iran's foreign minister has wrapped up a two-day visit to Geneva, where he addressed the 52nd session of the Human Rights Council. Hossein Amir Abdollahian elaborated on Iran's stance to promote world peace as well as friendly relations based on the principle of equal rights for all nations. The top diplomat also held separate meetings with high-ranking officials attending the session. Gisumi Shahamari has the details.
Terrorism laundering, a term which Iran's foreign minister's two-day visit to Geneva will be remembered by. Addressing the 52nd session of the Human Rights Council at the UN headquarters, Hossein Amir Abdollahian did not mince his words when it came to elaborating on the fact that Iran had been a victim of an unprecedented propaganda war. He said the rights of the Iranian nation were completely ignored during that war, launched by the same countries claiming to be advocates of human rights.
The role of anti-Iran terrorist groups in the recent crisis in my country was evident. Some states were involved in terrorism laundering while applying double standard. They provided considerable financial and logistical facility to some violent and terrorist elements during the unrest. The UN human rights mechanisms could and should contribute to the promotion and protection of human rights through genuine dialogue, constructive interaction, and respectful capacity-building cooperation.
Some European officials in particular, who then took the opportunity to meet with Amir Abdullahian. Several other meetings followed as well, involving officials from countries including Armenia, Indonesia, Senegal, and Venezuela, seeking stronger bilateral ties. Top UN officials also met with Iran's foreign minister, including Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Boosting cooperation was the key issue in the agenda of this pentilateral meeting. Iran is hosting over 5 million Afghan refugees, but international humanitarian organizations have not been offering any kind of help. On the other hand, unilateral sanctions have also exacerbated the situation of these Afghan refugees. The next session of this pentilateral meeting will be held in Tehran to discuss the situation further.
The UN Secretary General was informed of the efforts that Iran has made to solve the problems in Yemen, and Mr. Guterres demanded that we continue our efforts. Regarding Ukraine, Iran's stance was clarified. Iran is ready to use its potential for initiating a peace process. Iran's cooperation with the IAEA and the upcoming visit of the agency's delegation was also discussed in the meeting.
An issue that was reiterated by the foreign minister during the 2023 Conference on Disarmament, which started on the same day the 22nd session of the Human Rights Council was held, allowing the issue of human rights to be discussed in more detail.
We have several agenda items. We have more than 40 or 50 themes and around the same number of country situations that will be discussed over the course of this session. It is also a sign of the importance, I would say, that states and NGOs attach to the Human Rights Council as a venue to discuss issues which are often not heard in other venues. So it's incredibly significant.
This year marks 75 years since the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and 30 years since the adoption of the Vienna Declaration, two milestone documents that continue to guide the work of the Council. But it is very clear that we still have a long way to go.
The 52nd session of the Human Rights Council started on February 27th and will continue until April the 4th. Key issues on the agenda include the three Ps: promotion, protection, and prevention. Promotion of human rights, protection of those who fight for human rights, and preventing human rights from being violated. Gisum Isha Ahmadi, the Human Rights Headquarters in Geneva.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tourism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember in the previous episode, we briefly talked about a few foods in Golestan province and made you familiar with the simple recipe of these foods and sweets. In the fourth episode of this series, you will get familiar with another region of Golestan province, namely Kordkuy, and some of the foods and edibles of the region. Stay tuned, please. Kordkuy is located in the west of the northern province of Golestan. People in the region speak with Mazani dialect of Farsi language. This city is limited to massive forests on the south and the Caspian Sea on the north. The city is called Kordkuy, meaning region of Kurds, due to the migration of some Kurdish people from Uraman region in Kurdistan province in middle of 18th century. However, Kordkuy is home to several languages and dialects of various ethnicities which have migrated to the region. People of Kordkuy are very hospitable and sprightly. Among the most famous foods of the region, mention can be made of sock stew, pomegranate broth, nettle broth, stuffed kitchen and fish, and so on. Various sweets and cookies are also made in Kordkuy, among which we can mention walnut halva, berenjak, that is, special cookies made of rice and sugar, shirnoon or milky bread, and others. Women in Kordkuy usually prepare foods with local herbs. Some of these herbs are elzi or allium paradoxum, zolang or eryngium caucasicum, anorige, that is, fra repisop pita, oji or menta polygium, and gazane, that are Lamium nettles. Kordkuy is not far from the sea. Hence, seafood enjoys a special status in the cuisine of the region. Kipper is among the favorite fish of the people in Kordkuy. This fish is very useful in reduction of blood pressure, betterment of eyes, skin, and mental health. It also helps reduce cholesterol and triglyceride in blood. Well, kipper is used to make a food in Kordkuy called kapur kalle or head of kipper. This delicious food is usually served with soup or rice. To make this food, you will need kipper fish, garlic, parsley, onion, pomegranate paste, and spices. After a short break, you will hear the ingredients and recipe for two people. To prepare the popular food of Kordkuy city in northern Iran, you need these ingredients for two people. 400 grams of kipper fish that are cut into narrow pieces with the head and tail. Half of a middle-sized onion chopped into narrow pieces and another half grated. 20 grams of chopped parsley. 2 spoonfuls of fried garlic. 10 grams of fried mint and a spoonful of pomegranate paste, salt, black pepper, turmeric and oil as much as needed. Now the recipe. Pour 3 glasses of water into a pot and put it on fire to boil. Add the chopped fish with salt, black pepper and grated onion and let it cook for 15 minutes. Take the fish out and remove the thorns from it. Then put it into the pot again. Pour parsley, hot mint, hot garlic and pomegranate paste and let the kipper fish cook for another 15 minutes on a mild flame. Thus, your food is ready. We hope that you will make this food and enjoy it. Dear listeners, now let us get familiar with a kind of halva, which is quite popular in Golestan province and Kordkuy city. It is called Jose halva, that is walnut halva. It requires a lot of patience to make this halva. Interestingly, many of the sweets and cookies of the northern Iran are made of rice. So, rice is used to make walnut halva too. The ingredients for six people: a glass of rice, a glass of sugar, a glass of ground walnut, 3 spoonfuls of oil, glass of water. And the recipe: first soak the rice in water for 3 to 4 hours. Then grind it. Now pour oil in a copper or Teflon pot and pour the ground rice in it and let it cook mildly for nearly 5 minutes. Then add the chopped walnut and let it be on fire for around 10 minutes. In this phase, sugar and water are added and mixed completely. Increase the gas flame and stir the halva with a spoon for several 10 minutes. After 3 to 4 hours, it will become brownish. Now, it should be stirred continuously so that it becomes black. Once it is oily and does not stick to the pot, it is ready. Now, you should put out the oven and put a little oil on a tray and put the halva on it. Flatten the halva and cut it into pieces after cooling. Make it and enjoy it.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Germany has expelled 2 Iranian diplomatic staff. The reason: Iran's sentencing to death of a German-Iranian national who has confessed to terrorism charges. Iran has responded to Germany's move in kind, but why would Germany show support for a terrorist group ringleader and, by default, the terrorist responsible for Iranian deaths? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Germany's relations with Iran and why it has adopted a hostile approach towards the Islamic Republic. Our guests for this edition of the program include Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Also joining us is Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist who joins us from Houston, Texas. Welcome to you both. Elijah Magnier, first over to you. We're looking at an expulsion executed by Germany of the two diplomats over Iran's sentencing of a German-Iranian national to death, which was over terrorism charges. And, of course, then Iran has in kind done the same in terms of two of the German that they have expelled these two German diplomats. First of all, in terms of the act itself by Germany, isn't that a direct interference in Iran's internal affairs, including its judicial affairs?
It is indeed. It is an interfering in Iran domestic affairs, and this is not something that any country should do with another country. However, in the West, they have used to behave in a way where they think they can do what they want, and other countries are not allowed to retaliate in the same way. So if Germany is concerned about the move that Iran has done by expelling two German diplomats from Tehran, it should have thought about its move from the first beginning. And I think this tension is not related to the expelling diplomat from one side or another. It goes much deeper than that. It is the coalition of the U.S. and the EU together against Iran, trying to intimidate Iran, trying to put pressure on the Islamic Republic. And we cannot exclude this fact from the Iranian support to Russia and the JCPOA, because the nuclear deal is in limbo, and because the West is not abiding by its promise and its commitment, then they find all the excuses to escalate the tension.
Is the U.S. asking, or is the U.S. dictating to Germany?
I think the U.S. is dictating to all the West. The U.S. is dictating to Brussels, to Germany, to France, to every single European nation here, and we have seen this is not related only to Iran, but is also involving a kind of going toward a third world war where the U.S. is dragging everybody behind. And if we look at the relationship between Iran and the EU, we see a more positive approach by the EU. However, we see a more negative approach by the U.S. And then when the EU consider, by the announcement of Josep Borrell, who is the vice president of the EU Commission, saying that the Iran is bringing out a reasonable demand to reach the JCPOA deal, then we hear the Americans saying, well, no, it doesn't agree with us. And then the EU just stop talking and abide by the U.S. dictate. Uh-huh. So anything that is coming out of the EU is really, the EU has become the spokesperson of the U.S.
All right, Mohsen Nakhvi, we're talking about this a man by the name of Jamshid Sharmad, who is basically a terrorist. He's confessed to his role in acts of a U.S.-based terror group. The name is Tondar. The group itself is accused of planning and conducting terrorist activities inside of Iran. And based on what our guest there, Elijah Magnier, says, if you agree, I'm wondering what the context of the conversation would be if the U.S. is directing or dictating Germany. What is it saying to Germany? You need to defend this terrorist and therefore come and expel two diplomats, maybe? I mean, Germany says we do not accept the massive violation of the rights of a German citizen. The man's a terrorist. He's got blood on his hands. So it's pretty clear. What's your perception of the way that these two, if you agree, are colluding with each other to carry out the defense, in this case, of this terrorist?
They definitely are colluding with each other. Germany is taking its instructions from the U.S. empire, and that goes on to really think as to how sovereign the European Union or how sovereign Germany is in itself. But before I kind of dive into that, even when you collude or you want to somehow corner your enemies, so to speak, you need to do it in a fashion that is slightly smart. This is such a, and for the lack of a better word, a dumb way to get back at your enemies. Because what's Germany trying to say? What's the message that Germany is giving? Number one, do they not accept the constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran? Because the sentence is in line with the system that the constitution has confirmed, which is it goes on to reflect the will of the Iranian people and goes on to accept Islam in essence. The second possibility is that Germany is saying that German citizens are incapable of espionage. that German citizens are incapable of committing crimes. You see, the thing is that in Germany, there is no capital punishment. And that's why they take capital punishment very seriously. But one may argue that the reason why capital punishment was abolished in the late 1940s was primarily to cleanse Germany off of the crimes that Hitler had committed in World War II. So there was this agenda that they had when they abolished the criminal punishment in Germany. Having said that, Germany's silence when the United States executes innocent people in the U.S., or the fact that in the United States of America, the penalty for espionage can go up till the death penalty, and the fact that Germany is silent over that, it's quite clear that this is not an issue of policy, that this is not an issue of principle, but rather it's an issue of bullying a state that has become sovereign, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran. It goes on to make our narrative more concrete that Germany is taking instructions from the U.S. empire and is not sovereign itself. And there's no doubt that they are both colluding. I mean, Sharmad was arrested in 2020. The Iranian system of justice took its time. They took their time before they gave out their sentences. It was not a matter of arrest and then execute. They have done their investigations. This person was arrested, and he's responsible for killing more than 14 to 15 people and injuring more than 200 people in Shiraz.
All right. We need to cover this aspect of this terrorist group, Elijah Magnier, and bring to light the association this terrorist had in terms of its dictates to the group. First of all, the group is known as Tundar, and it's also called Kingdom Assembly of Iran. And what they want to do is the restoration of the ousted monarchy at any cost. And one of the things that this Sharmad has said, will show no mercy to anyone. Our stance concerning the overthrow of the Islamic Republic is quite clear. It's fist and bullet. Seven embassies in Iran will be annihilated. So when you hear that, Elijah Magnier, and perhaps people who are listening, doesn't that somewhat correlate to the way that some of this type of approach was infiltrated within the rioters? Because those are similar to some of the sentiments that these rioters have echoed in their protests, in the most recent protests or rioting that took place in Iran. It eerily sounds similar. So do you think that there's a connection there?
I think it goes deeper than that. Because since 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a different position, looking after its own constitution, the interest of the country, and no longer be submitted to the general dominance of the world. This is where the West is behaving in a way that there is a need to change the ruling system in Iran. And when Joe Biden just a few months ago said, we want to free Iran, so he said by saying he wants to free Iran, it means he wants to change the regime system, which means that this is a clear intervention in the Iranian affair. This is a violation of international laws and the UN Charter, not respecting the will of the population of Iran that elected their government and chose themselves with a referendum what kind of ruling system they have. If there is any change that needs to be done in Iran, it will be up to the Iranian people living in Iran to cast their vote, ensure the parliament, ensure the constitution, and make any changes that they want. It's not up to the West to interfere in Iran's affair, support riots, finance terrorist organizations. There are so many other organizations that are financed by the West, MEC, and then you can name several others. And then you have also all the sabotage that the Israelis and the intelligence services of the Mossad and the West is doing. So all that falls into one box. At the end of the day, they want Iran to submit. And when there is a deal between Iran and the West, when there is an agreement, all these small groups will disappear. But they have to agree to respect the Iranian sovereignty, and they have to bring back all the assets that they are confiscating that belongs to Iran and respect the Iranian will and the will of the population.
Sure. Well, recently, Mohsen Naqvi, we've had Iranian officials, including Iran's leader, who have, and the military top brass, many officials from there, and also intelligence ministries that have said that the U.S. and Europe have been dealt a very heavy blow when it comes to the incentives they had behind the riots and the way that that they backed it, that their defeat is very evident. Do you feel that this is what Germany has done is a backlash, that it's in response to the defeat that they have suffered, a humiliating one, at the hands of Iran, and therefore it's come out condemning the sentence that was placed against this terrorist and in turn expelling the two Iranian diplomats?
Absolutely. I think all of these measures are desperate. These are desperate tactics that the West is now using against the sovereign Islamic Republic of Iran. And they have been defeated on so many fronts, diplomatic fronts, military fronts, that now they just need an excuse to somehow criticize an action of the sovereign government. This has been the attitude of the West. You either agree with us or you're against us. So any respectful nation, any respectable nation would never bow down to this, to the bullying tactics of the West, especially of the US empire. I mean, the hypocrisy that we see on part of the US empire and its Western allies, that in false pretext, they go and attack Afghanistan after 9/11, and in false pretext, they go and attack and kill millions of innocent Iraqis in the false pretext of weapons of mass destruction, which they never found. And yet, there has been no repercussions by the International Courts of Justices against George W. Bush or against Tony Blair, for that matter. So this goes on to show the hypocrisy. And let's not forget that Europe, and specifically Germany, was a party to the attacks that were made upon Iraq and Afghanistan. Germany was a party to that. So the hypocrisy of the West in general should be criticized, and international courts of justice should finally open their eyes and take actions against the crimes that the West has committed against the innocent people of the world. And when we see protests happening in Iran, when we see organizations like Mujahideen-e-Khalq, when we see organizations like Tundar go and attack innocent Iranians, it is the very right of the Islamic Republic, and the Islamic Republic owes that to the Iranian nation to bring those people to justice who have committed these heinous crimes against the Iranians. Why this hypocrisy? No one should have the right to dictate local policy to any sovereign nation. And I think hats off to Iran for not bowing down to the US empire, for playing their game in their own area by doing tit for tat and expelling German diplomats just the way they did. Because this is the only language that the arrogant powers understand.
Sure. Well, another issue, Elijah Magni, is the fact that Germany has raised the issue of human rights. And it's gone after that issue quite vociferously when it comes to Iran. And they've even ratified a plan under the guise of supporting human rights. And, of course, this is in order to put pressure on the Islamic Republic. But I think Germany's forgetting that Iranians are not going to forget the way that Germany actually supplied Iraq's Saddam Hussein with 6,000 worth of chemical weapons of one kind or another during the Iran-Iraq war. That's something Iranians are not going to forget. And, you know, when they go and they sanction Iran that way, what kind of a message does that send in the way that Germany is behaving when it comes to Iran?
Well, I think the mere fact that Iran is responding in a kind of tit for tat, it sends a strong message to the West that you can't think of doing an act that is violating the sovereignty of another country and not expect a similar or even harsher reaction depending on what the foreign policy is of Iran. This was a very important message that Iran is sending back. Now, what happened during the Iran-Iraq war every single country in the West, including some Arab states, supported Saddam Hussein because they wanted really to defeat Iran, and they didn't really acknowledge the will of the population with the Islamic Republic. However, the people of Iran and the diplomacy of Iran is willing to put that on the side as long as the other country in the West, particularly Germany, France, Italy, and other countries, really respect Iranian sovereignty and Iranian integrity. Now, in this case, what Germany is doing, Germany is leading the way in Europe to follow the U.S. policy, not only against Iran, but we've seen it also in other issues. This is why it is not surprising to see tens of thousands of German and French and Spaniard in the street manifesting against their government, because there is a big gap today between the population and their leaders. So the decisions that are taken by the leaders in Europe today, we can see that all these decisions are incompatible with the interests of the European population. And showing such an aggressivity toward Iran is not beneficial to the European population. Making business with Iran, having good relationship with Iran, is in the benefit of the Iranian, of the European industry and the European economy that is suffering dearly, particularly with the war today between the U.S. and Russia on the Ukrainian soil, and all the sanctions that we have taken here in Brussels and are having the boomerang effect. So we really don't need another front with Iran and start meddling in Iranian affairs and then getting a hit back and then having bad relationship when we are desperately in need to restore the relationship with other countries, particularly when we see today that Asia is really turning toward itself, toward Africa and Latin America, and turning its back to Europe because it is considered that kind of a hopeless case, because the West, that represents 15 to 16% of the world population, is taking inconsistent decisions and unthoughtful decisions that are incompatible with the international relationship, with the international laws, with the UN Charter, and with their own benefit and their own interests.
Indeed. I mean, that's a great point that you make there, somewhat not related to the subject, but a very important one that I want to highlight there, Elijah Magner, and I thank you for that, is that you're looking at 15% of the population that's in the U.S., Canada, Europe, and Australia, but yet 85% of the rest of the world is comprised of the rest of that population. Of course, West Asia being that, and Asia, of course, Africa. Looking at the way that the destructive policy of the U.S. is, Mohsen Naqvi, many terrorist groups are either funded or are in the U.S. Tondar was located in the U.S., in Los Angeles. And I want to raise this point because it's important that during one of the TV channels that this terrorist was addressing a viewer that had called in, threatening the terrorist Sharmad, saying that he's going to reveal who he is or what he's doing. In response, Sharmat says, do you know where the FBI is located? It's in the same federal building where we are in, the center of the FBI, the federal building on the 10th floor. When there's this type of relationship that the U.S. has with these terrorist groups in one way or another, whether it's covertly or behind the scenes, it doesn't even really matter. It's taking Europe down that path. Europe is already now guilty of that. What can be done in order to prevent that? And hopefully for Europe to have its cage rattled and maybe have a reality check on itself.
German leaders and European leaders need to reflect the policy of their own people. They should not reflect or work towards the self-interest of the US. They should work towards their own self-interest. And the proximity of time and space that Europe has to Iran is a lot closer to the proximity that they have with North America. So Germany needs to play it smart. They need to play this Game of Thrones in a diplomatic fashion and not be bullied by the US and its foreign policy. You see, Germany has already too much to worry about with the war in with the war between Russia and Ukraine, meaning we already see the kind of implications and effects that war in that region has had on Europe, and there is more to come. So in these circumstances, for no reason to meddle within the private and sovereign affairs of Iran makes absolutely no sense. And as you have mentioned, that all terrorist organizations in today's day and age find their roots with the CIA or the FBI, may that be Tundar or may that be the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. And this is not something that's even covert, it's quite overt that we see. Bolton is quite open about its funding and their support to these banned terrorist outfits who have been responsible for killing giants in the Islamic Republic of Iran, like Shahid Beheshti, Shahid Bahonar, Shahid Mutahri for that matter, and the attack on the leader of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khamenei. So, and the very motto and the very objective of these organizations is to fight militarily against the Islamic Republic of Iran. So when we hear about these so-called coups, like the Green Movement that happened in 2008, I believe, and the recent protests that happened against, in which several Basijis were murdered during the Mahsa Amini protests, when we say that these were by the West, it's not a far-fetched idea. It makes logical sense that this is happening.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. We appreciate that, Mohsen Nahwi, human rights activist from Houston, Texas. Elijah Magnier, a pleasure. Journalist and political analyst from Brussels. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapwe and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the 9th divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet, the Messenger of Allah. Imam al-Jawad was also the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence undertook the imamate and the religious leadership of the Muslims after his father's death, the martyrdom of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. As historians have unanimously agreed, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was not more than 7 years old when he undertook the imamate and the religious leadership of the Muslims. Now, this great role of the imamate and the religious and spiritual and political leadership of the Muslims, of course, would not befit a keeper who had the mentality of a child and who was only a mere 7 years old. Because if one is to plunge into the fields of knowledge and wisdom, or enter into any kind of debate or controversies, especially so with great scholars and specialists, the amount of knowledge and wisdom needed must surpass that of even a very aged person. But we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, despite being not more than 7 years old, broke this notion and showed the world that though he was still a child, but because he was a divinely appointed imam on behalf of Allah, he was able to enter the fields of knowledge and wisdom and win in the debates and controversies against great scholars and specialists.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we are humbly talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, who was the 9th divinely appointed imam from the household of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. So, dear friends, I'm sure that we all know of individuals who, out in the open, they seem to be the most religious individual on the planet. But unfortunately, we find that sometimes these kind of individuals, behind closed doors, are not exactly the most religious of people. Now, sometimes we have this kind of experience when it comes to our friends or somebody that we are close to, because we see that individual both in the open and in public, and we also see that individual in the private. But instead of pointing our fingers towards others, have we ever thought about this as regards to ourselves? Are we incredibly religious in front of other people? Are we incredibly religious in public and out in the open? But when it comes to private gatherings, or when it comes to us being alone, does our religiosity just kind of melt away and we are left with a very irreligious position, condition, or status? Well, in a very beautiful conversation that Imam al-Jawad had with one of his contemporaries, and of